we firmly believe that everyone, every elected official, every citizen, every American should be doing what they can to help our elections be as participatory and accessible as possible, and that we should have a voting public that looks like all of us. That's how you get towards a representative democracy, and that's not partisan. I refuse to buy into the idea that it is.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Lauren Kunis, is the CEO and Executive Director of Vote Writers, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to ensure that all citizens are able to exercise their freedom to vote. Vote Writers help citizens with voter ID and voter ID education, and their team works alongside numerous partner organizations and volunteers to make this happen. Lauren's history includes working around the world for democracy at NDI, the National Democratic Institute, and in the U.S. with Nonprofit Vote. I enjoyed getting to know Lauren. You should listen too. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Lauren Kunis of Vote Writers.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Lauren, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Lauren Kunis. I am the executive director at Vote Writers, which is the nation's leading organization focused on the issue of voter ID. Previously, I was the program director for National Voter Registration Day, worked for almost a decade in international democratic development at the World Bank and the National Democratic Institute, and cut my organizing teeth on the Obama campaign way back in 2008. So I've sort of bounced around from campaign politics to doing civic engagement work overseas, and I'm really excited at this point in time to be doing this work here at home.
It seems like a cool career. Where'd you grow up and what kind of family?
I grew up in Rochester, New York, which is way upstate, close to the Canadian border. My first memory of politics and sort of elections and engagement was standing with my mom in the school parking lot. She was a public school teacher for many years. We were grabbing people to get them to go vote for the school budget to fund public schools. And I remember knocking doors with my dad for Bill Bradley way, way back when. I just dated myself.
It's not that early for me, I'll tell you that.
It was like a long time ago.
When I was a kid, Bill Bradley was playing for the Knicks.
Yeah.
And I was watching him play quite well.
Yeah. Yes. So my dad claims to have been a Bill Bradley fan because of his healthcare policy, but my dad is also a big Knicks fan. So hard to say.
Yes. So it sounds like it was a political household to some degree.
Yeah, a political household from sort of like the civic engagement and from an issues area. Absolutely.
Yeah. What kind of education did you obtain?
I did my undergrad work at Cornell University in Ithaca, and I majored in government, which is political science, essentially. I studied abroad in both France and Spain. I worked for the New York City government for a year after graduating as part of the Urban Fellows Program under the Bloomberg administration. And then I got my master's in nonprofit management at NYU at the Wagner School of Public Service.
Why did you decide to get that master's?
I really liked at NYU the practical focus. A lot about working in the nonprofit sector is management and systems and processes and organizations. So we sort of talked about it as an MBA, but for the public sector. I felt like the programming at NYU was really unique, and I loved that a lot of the professors were adjunct and had sort of real life experience to share with us. It made it a very, you know, my undergrad was more theoretical and liberal arts focused. And I liked the master's program that was very practical. If you want to make change, here's how you work within organizations to get that done.
At what point in your career did you get that?
Very early. Frankly, whenever I talk to people who ask for career advice now, I advise them to work a little bit more before going back to get their master's. But I also always really liked schools. Knew I always wanted to continue my schooling after undergrad. But yeah, I got it just after. I did internships in college and then worked for 1 year full time, but then went back to grad school pretty early, just 1 year out of undergrad.
What drew you to the Obama campaign? And tell me about that experience.
Ooh, yes. So I was working overseas at the time. So after I finished grad school, I was living and working in Madagascar in 2007 to 2008, and was having a really hard time being so far away from home in such an exciting and inspiring presidential election cycle. All the way from Madagascar, I remember interviewing with the team in Chicago. I had previously done an internship with the New York State Democratic Party and had some colleagues who were working in the headquarters. It was wild, even in Madagascar in 2008, everyone was talking about the historic nature of that campaign in the United States and how inspiring the candidate was. And I knew I would regret it if I didn't try at least to be a part of it. So I was lucky to be able to make that happen. And in the summer of 08, I moved back from Madagascar to work on the Obama campaign.
When my first daughter was young, she was very into animals, reading encyclopedias of animals and stuff. And I was always getting asked, what is your favorite animal? So I picked the ring-tailed lemur. Did you see those there? Is it a good choice for favorite animal?
It is. It's an excellent choice for favorite animal. They're pretty cute, pretty friendly. The ones at the touristy spots in Madagascar are a little overly friendly from time to time. But I have little kids too, as you know. And I will say the movie Madagascar is not quite factually accurate in terms of the biological species that actually live in Madagascar, but lemurs are everywhere.
We had to leave with my four-year-old Madagascar cartoon movie because it was too scary. So I, if you can imagine.
Absolutely. They can be pretty scary at night. If you're camping in Madagascar, the ring-tailed lemurs and the yellow eyes are a little scary.
I felt a little twinge of pain when you talked about how inspiring Obama was in 08, because we got a big election coming up. I'm a fan of the current president, Democratic president, but he's not drawing the way Barack Obama was, obviously, for a lot of reasons. And it makes a challenge for all of us on our side to not have the youth and groundbreaking candidacy that we had that cycle.
Yes. So speaking in...
I know that you are a nonpartisan operator here, but you, at that time, at least, you were focused on one side.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I will say from a little D Democratic engagement standpoint, there are lots of reasons to show up at the polls. And in 08, the reason drawing people to the polls might have been a biography and a historical landmark race, just because that isn't on the ballot this year, as far as we know, at least lots of time between now and November, there are just so many other incredibly important reasons to show up. Boiling it down to just little d democracy, I feel like the stakes could not be higher. I feel like this is a really existential race. I hope that significance is not lost on any single voter anywhere. And also lots of really inspiring local and state level candidates. You know, there's a ton on the ballot. It's not just the top of the ticket.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And ultimately, you're picking a team, not just an individual. It's all of the appointments. And there's going to just be a vast difference in direction of the country. So yeah, to some degree, we way overestimate the individual and the one office over the whole ballot that you would be casting. You're right.
I agree. You're thinking about policies and the people who are going to implement those and the impact that has on your daily life. And that's not about one person. It would be impossible for it to ever be about one person, but it's about sort of a vision and a common ideology and a commitment to progress.
So what did you learn working for that short time on that campaign? How did your time get spent and what came of it?
Yeah, so I was on the constituency outreach team, and I had the specific responsibility of sort of the grab bag of constituency groups that hadn't been sort of assigned much earlier in the race. So I had pretty niche sort of organizing community assignments, like Turkish Americans for Obama and small business owners. And I had Irish Americans for Obama, which is really fun because they had the O apostrophe Obama stickers that we got to make for them. But I feel like a takeaway for me was the importance of developing a message that resonates with people on the issues that they care about and recognizing that those are very different for very different groups. And it's important to see and show responsiveness to and have a thoughtful policy position and messaging on the issues that are most front of mind for people and recognizing how different that might be for different groups.
When I think about the career that you just mentioned and the stretch that you had, which was much more international, I really admire the people who bring that perspective back into our politics, because I think a lot of our voters and our operatives are a little myopic about just the United States and its history and its politics. And what we're experiencing right now is very similar to challenges that are being faced by countries all around the world, sometimes for very similar reasons. Tell me about the perspectives and what that brings to you when you're operating here.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I worked at the World Bank and when I worked at NDI, which is a nonpartisan organization supporting democracy and civic engagement and free and fair elections overseas, I worked on two regions primarily, and that was sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East. So the first part of my time, I worked on a lot of West African developing democracies like Mali and Guinea and Senegal. And then later on in my time at NDI, they gave me the really challenging cases like Syria and Iraq and some of the North African, you know, more quasi-democracies, lots of progress. I think it gave me a really important perspective in that I hear a lot of doom and gloom about American democracy right now. And I'm not saying that the state of our democracy is not fragile and it is not in need of sustained repair and reinforcement. But at the same time, I have worked in lots of countries that truly do not have a democracy. There is not a free media. There are not democratic norms. There is not the socialization around free and fair elections and the peaceful acceptance of results. I feel like it's given me a more optimistic frame through which to view the challenges of our own democracy. We have rule of law and we have vigorous civil society organizations, and we have a sustained culture of democratic engagement. And I think those are really important ingredients. At the same time, it helps me understand how fragile any democracy is, even if it's been in place for hundreds of years. It's really important to continually build up institutions, build up the systems and make sure they are equitable and participatory and easy to access. But it's also sort of given me some very surreal moments. I worked on the Syrian border with people who were trying to learn how to stand up local city councils that were democratically elected in free areas of Syria. And I was in Guinea when there was an attempted assassination of the president, and in Mali right after the coup, and sitting in my house in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, 2021, and seeing that unfold. I can see the Capitol from my house, and watching that was so surreal, because those experiences that I had lived overseas, never in a million years did I think I would be living that in the house where I live and I'm raising my young children. So it was really sobering, but made me very glad that I was working in a role where I was actively contributing to strengthening our own democracy and not spending my time overseas like I had for many years.
Yeah, what's terrifying is that a relatively small number of violent people can wreak havoc and can control a country in spite of being a tiny minority. Like if you think about how few the Taliban is in Afghanistan, how impossible to defeat and how they come back and take power over and over again, despite, I think, general preferences. Wow.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A organized and funded and vocal minority can often overshadow, either through violent means or institutional means, the will of the majority, which is why it's all that much more important to make sure that the majority is able to participate in elections and vote and understand the importance of what's at stake.
What was this National Voter Registration Day program that you mentioned? Tell me about what you did there.
So that was my job in 2019 to 2020 and through sort of part of 2021 as well. So National Voter Registration Day, it's a civic holiday. It takes place every September, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It is a national day encouraging everyone to register to vote and get everyone in their community to register to vote. And it's a civic holiday. The goal is to make it nonpartisan and celebratory and fun. And what I loved about it was we galvanized this huge, diverse coalition of different partners to encourage voter registration on that single day. Clear ask, register to vote. So that was sort of the normal voter engagement groups, the League of Women Voters, Black Voters Matter. Everyone was out there in the communities doing that work, but also lots of more non-traditional partners. So lots of private sector organizations, lots of media organizations, lots of talent and celebrities. It was sort of this a very cross-sectoral effort to make sure that everyone was registered to vote in time to cast a ballot in 2020 and then win every election after that, of course.
Any effort to register people to vote seems like a good thing. What annoys me about it is that we have to register at all. And there are places where that is automatic. What's your view on the whole notion of having to register to vote? If we could wave a wand and change national policy on that, what do you think would be the ideal?
I think there are lots of examples already in the states of places where registration is not tied to citizenship or age, but it's much more accessible. Pennsylvania just implemented automatic voter registration dating back way back to the early 90s with the passage of the MVRA. Voter registration became much more accessible and much more integrated into sort of service delivery touch points. Like the DMV is the obvious one, but there are lots of other government agencies where people are going to interact and receive public services that have done a really good job of mainstreaming voter registration into it. I would love to see even more. I would love at every single college and university, when you're getting your, you know, new student package, you also get the opportunity, if you're eligible, to register to vote in the state. I would love it if, you know, libraries and...
But why even have to do that? Why not? I mean, we have lists of everybody. Why can't you just show up and vote? People in your area know who you are.
Yeah, no. And I mean, lots of the countries I've worked in overseas don't have a specific voter registration process. Instead, you have sort of a national citizen card. In rural Africa, everyone does know who you are and you can walk in. It's more accessible. But in the United States, I mean, I do think there is some value in signaling to election officials how many voters may show up to participate. So there are sort of logistical and election administration related reasons for voter registration. But absolutely, it's an additional barrier. I mean, there are people who argue that it stems from systemic racist policies seeking to limit the franchise.
Racist or classist? I mean, I've talked to plenty of people who think ignorant people shouldn't vote, let's say. I think that we are all created equal in this democracy and we all ought to be voting. And who is to say whose opinion is better than someone else's?
Right. No. And I mean, not just racist. You're absolutely right. Like racist, classist, sexist.
Women couldn't vote for the longest time.
Exactly. Which, you know, I love
mind-boggling like, now.
Right. Like that blows my mind. It blows the mind of my 8-year-old, but it didn't blow the mind of several generations prior to me. So I feel like, you know, working on democracy work in places like Syria and Iraq forces you to be an eternal optimist. So, I mean, I do take a lot of solace in the fact that the history of our country has been expanding the franchise steadily to get beyond these racist and classist and sexist systems that were oppressing and limiting the franchise. I think there have been setbacks in recent years for sure. When we look at some of the voting policy that's passing at the state level and the lack of national legislation to set standards for voting rights. But I do think the history of America is one of steadily expanding the franchise. And I love that we're pushing to always do even better.
Yeah. I mean, we have certainly not had a linear path to progress, but we have had, if you ignore the valleys, we have been climbing to some degree.
Right.
For a long time. Yeah.
That was a sort of talking point I would use a lot overseas. The sort of overall trend line is good, but that's not to minimize the dips down. And I think on a lot of basic rights in our country right now, we're experiencing a dip down.
Sounds like an interesting experience to be involved in that voter registration thing. How did you become involved in Vote Riders and what is it?
Yes. So I first heard of Vote Riders when I was working at National Voter Registration Day, because getting registered is one step, but it is far from the only step in being able to successfully cast a ballot. So in that role, we partnered with Vote Riders. So Vote Riders is focused on voter ID. In 38 states right now, registration is part of the process, but in order to cast a ballot successfully, you're either required or requested to show a specific form of ID. So Vote Riders offered lots of complimentary resources and free help to get people get ID once they were registered. So I had worked with Vote Riders in that capacity and was thrilled to get the opportunity to come work with the organization full time in 2021.
It was founded by Kathleen Unger, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of the founding story for the organization? How does that come about?
Yeah, absolutely. She can tell it better than me. But Kathleen, who's a leading attorney based in California, founded Vote Riders in 2012. I don't think even Kathleen could have guessed the extent to which voter ID laws would explode in the years after that. So she had been very involved in election protection as a volunteer attorney and felt like there was a real lack of attention given to the very complicated and confusing and costly issue of voter ID. So in 2012, after doing lots of consultations with different actors and stakeholders, she decided to found the country's first, I would say, organization specifically focused on voter ID and helping at-risk voters understand those laws and address mounting barriers to the ballot box that were caused by voter ID laws. In 2013, there was a huge spike in the passage of voter ID laws after the Shelby v. Holder Supreme Court case that really gutted the Voting Rights Act. And then in the period 2020 to today, we've seen a second really unprecedented wave of the passage of voter ID laws across the country. So Vote Riders has grown a lot since 2012. Unfortunately, it's been in response to greater need for our specific work, but we're really glad to be filling that gap for voters when the challenges related to ID laws are greater than they ever have been.
Was the transition from Kathleen to you as leader?
So Kathleen was the founding president and CEO and everything at Vote Riders. We had no full-time paid staff between 2012 and about 2018, I believe. But then Dave Griggs, who you may have met, I feel, he was the first executive director at Vote Riders starting in 2018. Since then, we've grown our staff to, we're at 25 right now and hoping to be five or six bigger before the middle of this big election year.
In what kind of shape was the organization when you came on?
The organization has an extremely strong model. I feel so deeply that we are meeting a really underaddressed need. I think like any sort of small, scrappy nonprofit started in 2012. It's helpful to sort of go through phases of organizational development where you are ready to go, not just from 0 to 1, but 1 to 5 and 6 to infinity, you know? So in the post-2020 period, which is a big stress test for any voting rights organization, you raise more money, do more voter contact, hire more staff. We had a lot of lessons learned in terms of how we could build systems and processes that would put us in a position to scale even more in the years ahead. So a lot of my 2021 work with our team was building out the operations and finance and reporting systems that have really been a great foundation for us as we've grown enormously since then.
How much does that master's you took, which seems directly related to that, serve you? Or is it more like learning on the job sort of thing?
No, it has served me so well. The only regret I have is that I didn't like keep all my coursework. And, you know, I wish I didn't get that specific master's like a decade before I was in an organizational leadership position. It's really been effective. The sort of theoretical underpinning of a liberal arts degree and political science is really important, but the nuts and bolts of running an organization are different. And I would argue the most important thing in thinking about how to lead and grow a nonprofit organization, no matter what the subject area is. But yeah, I definitely was finding myself going back to old coursework and actually got in touch with some professors from grad school. And I was like, hey, I'm looking for some advice on this. It's been a great resource.
That's awesome. What do you think are the characteristics of a good leader of a nonprofit like yours or similar allies out there?
Yes. I think you need to be a mix of bold and visionary and optimistic, while also being very detail-oriented. You can have a great vision, but if you don't have the ability to roll up your sleeves and say, we need to have this tracker in place and we need to set up these financial reporting systems, you're not going to be able to realize that vision. I think a lot of it is also about setting up your team to succeed and hiring the right people, giving them the right support, but also letting them feel empowered and autonomous in making decisions and sort of taking the ball and running with it.
Is it hard to be optimistic and bold when some of the tides that you can't control are against you?
It is, absolutely. But I will say, I love that vote riders and other jobs I've had are an outlet for feeling like I'm doing something about that. I feel like it's so tough sometimes to read the news and doom scroll and really sort of get sucked into this downward spiral doom and gloom narrative. But it's important to be cognizant of the challenges that we're up against because they are real. But I also love that I'm able to dedicate so much of my energy and blood, sweat, and tears towards doing something that I feel is really productive and countering the bigger environmental challenges out there.
I assume that you're aware of an organization called Spread the Vote, Kat Calvin, and I've talked to her a couple times on the show. When I most recently did, what stuck in my mind from that interview was how widespread the problem of ID in general is, like the millions of people, depending on what study you go to, that in this country that just don't have that among their personal documentation. And in fact, it's a lot of effort on an individual basis for them to go through the process just to get an ID. And when you're talking about millions of people, her efforts over years have like made a 20,000 person dent into that, which is a lot of people when you think about it one by one, but a tiny proportion of the issue. How much does knowledge of that, the size of that problem, how does that lens affect how you think about your work and how big do you think the problem is when you think of it only from a voter ID perspective?
100%. So when we think about voter ID laws in the context of voting rights, I think the challenge is really twofold. One bucket is voter education. Voter ID laws are passing at wild rates. They're complicated. They're changing. So a lot of our work is focused on helping voters unpack and understand what the ID laws are in their state for voting in person and voting by mail. The other challenge is exactly what you just lifted up, which is the direct disenfranchisement that voter ID laws cause. More and more states are requiring specific forms of ID to be able to cast a ballot, and they're limiting that list. So in Ohio, for example, a lot of students used to bring a zero balance utility bill from their dorm room to vote at the polls. That's no longer accepted. You need an in-state Ohio ID, which lots of students who come from out of state don't have an interest or time or resources to go get. So the second bucket of our work is voter ID assistance and helping people every step of the way, covering every single cost they incur to help them get the ID they increasingly need to vote. So our work on the voter education side is text banking and letter writing and making phone calls and doing trainings and passing out literature. And the voter ID assistance side is lots of meeting communities where they are, doing site-based work at high schools and colleges and food banks and shelters to help people get the ID they need. And something that was new to me, frankly, even when I started working at VoteWriters, I understood the voter ID challenge when it came to accessing the ballot box, but I did not have a full understanding of the extent to which this plastic card is not just what you need to vote, it's what you need to access stable housing for your family and get a job in the formal sector. And if the police pull you over, you need to show it or else you're going to jail. You know, there are so many other cross-cutting benefits and needs that getting that ID unlocks above and beyond voting.
What's the scale of your voter ID assistance part of what you do? Like, how many people do you end up helping lately?
Last year, we reached over 6 million voters with our efforts. So that was cutting across the voter education, like sending lots of text messages, doing lots of digital campaigns, and also the voter ID assistance work. Last year, we helped about 10,000 people get a state-issued ID. So obviously a much smaller slice of our bigger reach, but helping an individual takes weeks. Sometimes it takes months. It can take between $50 and $100, depending on what types of documents you need, if it's just an ID or if you need a birth certificate and social security card also. So the scale is enormous. It really cannot be understated. And it's going to take years of fighting back with boots on the ground, as well as this is not where VoteWriters sits, but also sort of systemic level reexamination of the policies that are systemically disenfranchising people.
Who are your allies in the policy around voter registration and ID that people ought to know about?
Yeah, so we work with lots of organizations across the country at the state and local and national level to make sure that ID is part of every conversation with voters. So on the voter education piece, we also work with a lot of non-traditional partners, specifically on the voter ID assistance piece. Goodwills and Salvation Armies who do more employment-focused work, shelters so that we can help people get access to more stable housing and the ballot box. In 2020, we did lots of work with public health organizations that when people were getting their COVID vaccine, we were also able to help them get ID. We did a really interesting study to sort of your question about the scope and scale of the problem earlier. We did a study last year with the Brennan Center for Justice, the Center for Democracy and Civic Engagement at the University of Maryland. It's a long name, but that's always a mouthful for me. And also PublicWise, to do the first study, a national study in almost 20 years, of who lacks ID, what the barriers are, and the extent to which voter ID laws cause confusion. And happy to go into more of the weeds there or also share out the link to that study.
Do both.
So the findings were really astounding. Something we hear in our work every day at VoteWriters is, oh, are voter ID laws that big of a deal? Do people really not have a driver's license? I thought everyone has one. The answer is absolutely not. So our study found that almost 15% of voting age Americans, which is 34.5 million people, didn't have an unexpired government issued photo ID with their current name and address on it. So some people did have a driver's license, but it had an address that no longer matched. It had their maiden name and they since got married or they changed gender. So people did not have an updated identity document with their current information. And that can cause a lot of confusion and problems with registration and at the polls. We also had a lot of really eye-popping findings when it came to voter confusion. So we asked people if they knew if they needed to bring photo ID to the polls or if they weren't sure or if they did. 55% of voters who live in a state where voter ID is required to cast a regular ballot didn't know or weren't sure that they needed to bring that to the polls. So that confirmed a lot of the sense we got from doing this work on the ground, that voter ID laws cause immense confusion. A lot of times even poll workers don't quite know what the voter ID laws are in their state. So it really reinforced for us the need to continue in a big way growing our work on the voter education piece to help address confusion and to also really do everything we can to scale up the voter ID assistance piece, knowing that millions of Americans, disproportionately young, BIPOC, low-income individuals, lack a current and unexpired form of government-issued ID, which, as I was saying before, you need in more states than ever before to vote, but also to do lots of other important things in life.
I think a lot of people might hear how there's a disparate impact in different communities of these kind of laws through a partisan lens. In this polarized time, it's almost impossible not to. How do you, as an organization that isn't partisan, how do you view the politics of what you do?
It's tough. I mean, it is a really sad turn, in my opinion, that voting rights and being able to exercise your freedom to vote has become more partisan now than, at least in my lifetime, it ever has been. You know, there used to be universal across the aisle acceptance of that. And at Vote Writers, I should have said this early, but we draw our name and inspiration from the Freedom Writers and really put a lot of intention on carrying forward that legacy. I always push back and say, this is not partisan. This is patriotic. This is helping every eligible citizen cast a ballot in their community on the issues that are important to them. And to a certain extent, you just need to ignore the noise and focus on doing the work. We're a nonpartisan organization, and we firmly believe that everyone, every elected official, every citizen, every American should be doing what they can to help our elections be as participatory and accessible as possible. And that we should have a voting public that looks like all of us. That's how you get towards a representative democracy. And that's not partisan. I refuse to buy into the idea that it is.
How big is Vote Writers right now in terms of number of employees?
We have 25 staff members. We are a remote organization, but we have field staff on the ground in 8 states. So those are Arizona, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Wisconsin. And those are states that have really tight margins, that have restrictive voter ID laws. Almost all of them have new and stricter ID laws since 2020 alone. And those are the states where we know our work on the margins could be a difference maker when it comes to making sure people know about voter ID laws and have the ID they need to vote. So our work is national in scope. We have digital resources and virtual support available for all voters. But the bulk of our field programming in 2024 is going to be concentrated on those 8 states because of their outsized impact for us in terms of the issue we work on and the landscape in those states.
Where does your funding come from?
We are grateful to receive support from lots of different sources, lots of individuals. We have a board of trustees, lots of low dollar donors. Our average donation size, last I saw, was hovering around $35, I want to say. So lots of grassroots support. We also, in the last couple of years in particular, have expanded our institutional sources of support. So from foundations, including the Heinz Endowment and the Rockefeller Foundation, to the Houston Endowment, to PublicWise, we've been really grateful to get on the radar of more and more long-term institutional funders. We also do a growing size of work with companies and brands. We worked with Target and Microsoft, for example, last year to do nonpartisan employee engagement events where their staff wrote letters and sent text messages to voters, making sure they knew what the ID laws were and offering free help from vote riders. And those companies typically make a financial donation to support our work as well and sort of offset the cost of doing that nonpartisan volunteer event.
So what would a successful 2024 look like for you?
Big question. That's what keeps me up at night. So our goal for 2024 is to reach 10 million voters directly with information on voter ID that is accurate and trusted and up to date, and also support a growing number of voters to get their questions answered and get ID documents. So we're shooting for at least 15,000 voters that we help on a one-on-one basis through our helpline, through our chatbot, or through our kind of site-based voter ID clinics, which are ID assistants. So that's sort of the quantitative goal. I feel like qualitatively, I want to make sure that we are working in partnership and coalition with as many other organizations out there. I often say that Vote Riders punches above our weight because partnerships are so part and parcel to our model. So all the groups out there knocking doors and making phone calls and running digital ads, we want to make sure that they are offering our free ID services. We want to make sure that they are making sure to uplift the importance of ID. And I think I also really want to see Vote Riders continue to be a thought leader and trusted expert in the realm of all things voter ID, which is going to be more of an issue this year than it ever has been. So making sure that we raise awareness among the media and the general public and partner organizations and election officials about the confusion and disenfranchisement that comes from voter ID laws.
I'm full of mixed feelings about this because when you talk about reaching 10 million people, you're talking about less than 10% of the voters. When you talk about helping 15,000 people, that might be a lot if it was really close elections in small number of states. But honestly, it is a small number systemically. It's a large number for you guys to handle. It feels like we have this array of nonprofits and other organizations that are chipping away at big problems. We also have much larger institutions and forces that are capable of moving the facts on the ground a long way, maybe not even that expensively if they control a legislature, shall we say. When you think into the longer term, what are the ideas that you have about reaching another couple orders of magnitude of scale? Or is that not the role for you? How can we deal with these problems, which are bigger than your group and your allies probably can handle, unfortunately?
Yeah, I mean, I will say I love how scalable our model is. I mean, we have seen our volume triple at least in terms of voters reached and assisted since 2020 alone. So I'm really confident that sort of in the here and now, in the next months, we're going to be doing everything we can. We also have a really important multiplier effect in that lots of organizations are using our resources. So our sort of reach of 10 million is the ones we directly reach. The sort of rings outside of that of people using our resources and getting trained by us to do this work independently makes the indirect reach and impact much greater. At the same time, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think for us, where we sit as Vote Riders, our sort of strategic and comparative advantage is the programming in the immediate term and here and now. I think there's absolutely another track that is more systemic and policy-based. And we can't ignore the immediate term needs and focus exclusively on policy advocacy, which is not something that Vote Riders does. But our hope is that both tracks move forward so that voter ID laws do not continue to disenfranchise and confuse tens of millions of Americans every single year.
There are lots of organizations that run voter registration drives, and there's technology providers that assist people in getting registered, filling out forms online where that's not illegal. Is it, in any of those campaigns, is your ability to help people with the voter ID problem kind of wired in at all, so that somebody's running a campaign, if the person being reached for voter registration has the ID problem, that they know to go to you?
Yes, absolutely. And that's our goal. We want to do as much as possible with groups like that to help people understand it's not just getting registered, it's also making sure you have ID. We have a partnership with Rock the Vote, for example, where every month they send us a list of people who start the registration process online and drop off at the point at which they're asked to enter ID information, which you need to do in most states to do online voter registration. And we then take that list and follow up with them and say, we heard you might need ID help. We're here. And we have a similar partnership with Black Voters Matter. They have a question in all of their walk scripts for people who are on the doors doing canvassing, saying, do you have a current state-issued ID? And if they say no or I don't know, they send us a list of those voters. So we follow up with them. We work with Headcount, for example, with just voter registration at concerts and sporting events. Their volunteers are trained when they're doing voter registration to also hand out what we call a voter ID information card. So once they're registered, they say, and guess what? You live in the state of Florida. Here's a list of the accepted IDs you need to bring to the polls. Contact vote writers if you need help. So we want to do as much as we can to partner with groups doing voter registration, knowing that it's only with that additional voter ID help that every voter is going to be able to register and then successfully cast a ballot.
The technologist in me, when I heard get a list monthly, blanched a bit. Is that something where it would make any sense to have a daily reporting of these sort of things from the different groups, where, or is the queue long and you can't get to everybody anyway? Or what's the reality about ability to cope with incoming needs?
Right. No, that's a good point. So, I mean, with Rock the Vote in particular, like, we're always sort of adjusting the cadence based on the flow. Right now is a slower period for online voter registration than August and September will be. So this was a little bit before my time at Vote Writers, but when we started this partnership in 2020, I think it was every couple weeks. We have other partners on the ground in Texas, for example, that send us weekly lists. Even though those are smaller, we're able to follow up more rapidly. So absolutely. I mean, there are some groups where it's just like a little bit more of a lift to pull the list on a daily basis. So a week or a month or every 2 months works better for them. No, it's a good point. As much as we can, we want sort of systems to talk to each other. We're a State Voices partner. So we are, with VAN, able to sort of integrate voter outreach and contact with other groups in this space.
Is there a convening place for voter registration, voter ID related issue, people to get together and figure out how to cooperate better, how to accelerate and do more of the kind of things that we've just been discussing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that exists at the national level and also at the state level. So, you know, we, in all of the states where we have field programs, if there is one, a priority for us is always joining the C3, what they call table. So it's a working group of C3 nonpartisan organizations in the state convened by a State Voices affiliate. There's often a voter registration working group, a voter education working group, depends on the state, but there are weekly or monthly meetings and resource hubs and shared voter contact lists. So lots of that going on. At the national level, we attend the America Votes Conference every year. We're a State Voices national partner, and also partner with other groups with a national presence like the League of Women Voters or Headcount or When We All Vote, to make sure that we're sort of synced up at every level to make sure that our programming is not reinventing the wheel, that our voter ID programming is additive to other efforts, making sure we're sort of maximizing efficiency because the stakes are really high. We have to do that.
It sounds like a lot of work.
Sometimes, yeah, you know, it's a big election year. So yeah, I think it is.
So what is keeping you in this role? What is it that you like about it? And how long do you think you can keep pushing this stone up the hill?
Yeah. Ooh, Good question. I think this work is really exciting to me. It's important, not just professionally, but personally committed to it. I don't think every single year will have the pace of 2024, nor should it. You know, honestly, what keeps me going is seeing the rising need for our work and the extent to which we at Vote Writers are really successfully able to fill this niche. I feel like the threats to democracy are coming at all of us from every level. There's like AI and misinformation, and then there is intimidation and political violence, and then there's restricted voting access. And I feel like the ID piece is a relatively unprotected piece of that sort of threat environment, if you will. So it's really gratifying to be working in a place where I feel like we're very thoughtful and strategic and impactful. In my role, I don't do much or really any sort of frontline sitting with voters and helping solve problems and get IDs, but we have a huge emphasis on capturing those stories and uplifting them and amplifying them to sort of put a human face and build empathy for the issue we're working on. So hearing the stories like that to me are really heartwarming and energizing and what keeps me going when things get tough or tiring, which is more often the closer we get to November, I think.
Where are you on the balance of optimism and pessimism about our election systems that you're one part of?
I'm hardwired to be an optimist. I think the threats are real, but having seen countries where there is no democracy, I remain optimistic about our ability to use this crisis moment to build a democracy and supporting institutions that are more resilient, that are more inclusive, and hopefully to emerge on the other side of this threat stronger for having weathered the storm, if you will.
Well, I sure hope we do, and I appreciate your efforts in trying to help us do that. Is there something I should have asked you that I failed to?
I don't think so. No, just appreciate the opportunity. We feel like this is an issue that doesn't get talked about enough. So always glad to make sure that it's front of mind for voters and partners and everyone else.
I noticed on your website that you have a map of different voting laws by state. People can learn about what their situation looks like. Where should they go to get more information or to help you?
Yes, we need all the help we can get this election cycle. If you go to voteriders.org, that's our website. We have an interactive and bilingual state-by-state map of the ID you need to vote in person and by mail. We have a bilingual helpline and chatbot that anyone with ID questions or someone who needs help getting an ID can call or text. That's 866-ID-2-VOTE. The number two. The chatbot is also something you can access right on our website to be connected with someone about all things voter ID. We're also always looking for volunteers. We have a community of over 10,000 volunteers that do everything from send text messages to write handwritten letters to answer calls and texts to our helpline to working with voters in their community to help them get an ID. You can go to our website to learn about opportunities to plug in there. It's voteriders.org/volunteer. And if that is not realistic or feasible, we're always looking for support to help us sustain and scale this important work and welcome donations of any size. Every dollar counts when we're trying to reach as many voters as we can this year and also in the years beyond.
Lauren, it's an honor to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
No, just thank you.
That was Lauren Kunis. She is at voteriders.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.